welcome to this week's episode of The Art of Authenticity. I'm Laura Coe, your host, and thanks again for tuning in. Today is a really special day for me because I have one of my dear, dear, dear friends, Dr. Beth Ritchie, joining us. She is the director of the Institute of Research on Race and Public Policy and a professor of African American Studies, Criminology, Sociology, Gender and Women's Studies, and Criminal Law and Justice at the University of Illinois at Chicago. She's also a senior advisor for the NFL on gender violence. Beth is somebody who, if you met her, you would love her as much as I do. She's just this warm, amazing, charismatic human being that you will hear during this interview. But she's also somebody who has been an activist for her entire career, and she's going to bring stories today from early days in New York, where she was one of the original six women who started the idea of women's shelters, how that experience shaped her career and her focus in trying to bridge the gap between the women who were underprivileged experiencing domestic violence and domestic violence as a whole for privileged white culture. Beth has been instrumental in moving this conversation forward, but she's also honest and candid and open and shares with us many ways in which she feels the system is still struggling today, as most of us are aware with the movements like Black Lives Matter. Tune in, listen to today's show. She's just got so much insight. I feel like every point she made, I could have dove into for an hour. She's got such depth of experience and knowledge. So thank you for tuning in. If you're interested in learning more about this episode, as always, come over to lauracoe.com/podcast. You'll find Beth Ritchie with all the show notes, a link to any crisis hotlines if you are somebody out there who's in an abusive relationship, and any other podcasts that you're interested in. Again, thank you for tuning in, and I hope you enjoy today's show. This week, we have a very special guest joining us, very dear, dear friend of mine. Beth Ritchie is here. Hi, Beth.
Hi, Laura.
So the backstory of this is Beth and I are friends. We live in the same neighborhood. Our children go to school together, and I have been after Beth for, I think, 6 months.
6 months, Laura, at least 6 months.
To come on here because about 2 years ago, I want to say, yeah. I came to a book tour lecture series at a bookstore down in Chicago and heard her speak about her latest book. And I was just so struck by the story she told that I've been haranguing her ever since to come on and share it with all of you. So I know you're going to love today's episode. But before we get to the book and the story, I just wanted to back up a little bit because I've had dinners with Beth, I've hung out with her, and I haven't actually heard the story myself. Mm-hmm. You teach and write about African American studies, women, and violence in the criminal system. But how did you land there? Like, I know you went to school, you did this early on, but was this a passion that you had in college, high school? Like, when did this ignite for you?
Good question. So first, I think for me, I remember as a kid growing up, I grew up in a house where my parents were very committed to racial justice, did a lot of activism, even with four young children, involved in the civil rights movement, went to the March on Washington, involved in local politics. And it was always framed around racial justice and kind of growing up. This was, you know, the 1960s, growing up as Black children in a middle-class Black family, but still with accountability to people who had a lot less privilege than us. Mm-hmm. We didn't talk as much about gender, but I remember noticing how different my family was than like my friend's family. You know, my mom was a peer activist with my father. My grandmothers were very engaged in kind of civic work. Both of them worked outside the home. My mom did sort of off and on. And so I remember being aware of gender. Racial justice was sort of more explicit in how they lived and what we talked about. But I remember thinking that they were doing something around gender parity. And that's what I would call it now. Then I would call it like, my mom's an equal partner to my dad.
My mom's kind of cool.
Yeah.
Like hanging in there.
And so I feel like it was kind of in my blood, really in my blood from being a very young child.
And this was something that you felt passionate and organized around, because sometimes our parents are interested in things and we revolt against it.
Yeah, that didn't happen for me. I mean, I really felt like what they were doing was what I wanted to do.
That's so cool.
My dad was a dentist. My mother was a librarian, but I'm talking about their other work.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I didn't want to be a dentist or librarian, but I did want to be an activist.
That's right.
And when I got to college, you know, there's lots of opportunities to do that on a college campus. I did it in high school too, really, but on, you know, college kind of provided this wide open space to do this work. And it kind of grew from there.
And when did you, so you've put together women's studies, violence, the criminal system. How did you meld these things? Like it's something I don't feel I hear often.
Yeah, it isn't, it's not a sort of common combination of people doing work. That's part of the problem, that it's not commonly combined.
Oh, that's part of the problem that people
aren't seeing the links between these spheres of potential advocacy and activism. Mm. I was working in a neighborhood health center in Harlem when I graduated with my MSW before I went back to school to get my PhD. And it was a place, like my family, where there was very explicit discussion around racial and economic justice. Ran a Head Start Center, a healthcare clinic, did educational reform, talked about ending poverty. And I noticed, because it was so different than what I had expected to see, that women were doing the work but weren't articulating the vision, that women would come to meetings but would feel afraid to go home at night after the meetings, that their leadership, their voices weren't kind of central to the analysis. And so it was really then, after college, in my first job, working in a neighborhood health center in Harlem, predominantly Black community, full of activism and mm-hmm. organizing, where I realized that like women's voices were absent. And I started to kind of delve deeper into that and realize that part of why they're absent is they were afraid. They were in abusive relationships. They didn't feel their power. Even though they were doing a lot of work, they didn't feel their power. Not everybody, but that was, you know, a common mm-hmm, theme. Mm-hmm. So I set up a support group for women to talk about why that was true. It was really, it just kind of came that organically.
And just for everybody listening, you have to remember this is like before women's shelters,
that's right?
I mean, it's hard to even imagine, right? Like words like domestic violence or these things that we take for granted, nobody spoke that way.
Nobody spoke that way.
Yeah.
And I would say 3 years into having these kind of sidebar discussions with women around how we could organize as peers with men, like I had seen happen in my family, I heard about a conference in another part of New York City where women were getting together to talk about the issues of violence. And so I got on the train, left Harlem, went downtown to Lower Manhattan, sort of a New York story. And there was this group, this room full of women, every single one was a white woman, talking about rape and battering and sexual harassment and stalking and kind of the fear that comes with those being part of women's everyday experience, just like I was hearing from the women that I was working with in Harlem. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I walked into the room so excited, Laura, like finally there's people talking about what we're, but there was no analysis of racial injustice or of poverty or of the need for meeting basic needs of food and shelter. I mean, the only discussion of shelter was shelter to get away from violence, not shelter because you're homeless, right?
Right. So it was kind of through a lens, but more of a singular lens.
A singular lens, a gender-only lens. Back uptown in Harlem, it was like a racial-only lens. Mm-hmm. And I didn't know whether to like stop in the middle. It's like, where is the place where there's a discussion about both of these things? Mm-hmm. So I'm moving along trying to say, could some of the women come with me downtown? Could some of the women come meet uptown? Like, where do I find? But I felt like these worlds were so far apart. I mean, it was like a 20-minute train ride, mm-hmm. but it felt like different worlds. Like people were just living in different worlds.
Well, again, social media, the news cycles, the like things were separated
they
more.
Were.
We
That's
didn't
right.
we didn't interact through all these systems that at least gave us visual images of how people were experiencing different things.
Right. And you're right to point out that there weren't a lot of services. So it was also a time when people were, if they were going to seek shelter, they were going to go to like their neighbor or their cousin or their sister. So there wasn't a formal apparatus where people would go like to an agency where they would meet people who were strangers who might be more racial or ethnically diverse or come from a range of communities. They were much mm-hmm. more likely to go to a place where they felt they could get some help because there weren't established services at this point.
To a friend's house, to a neighbor's house.
Yeah.
And so you had said in this talk you had given that you just started to get money together to just try to help sort of woman by woman, like yeah. out of this yeah. situation is.
Well, and it, you see, to me again, that's why it's important to, for me to remember growing up, I expected that the logic, like if I could get the black men, predominantly black men running this health clinic to get it about women, like mm-hmm. I could say, this is injustice. This is inequality. This is causing suffering. This is impeding, you know, the growth of our community. I kept saying, don't you get it about women's position in this community? And similarly, when I was talking to the predominantly white women, increasingly with the feminist consciousness, I'd say, but don't you get that women are different from each other? And when you talk about gender, it means something different if you don't have any money. And, mm-hmm. you know, so mm-hmm. I kept thinking that if I just kept talking to people, somehow they would
bridge
listen.
This gap.
Right. And
bridge
it just didn't happen. And so with a group of other women, there were, I think, six of us at the time, we started writing grants explaining the gap that the distance between these two communities were facing and the problems, therefore, of women who were like us, women of color who were trying to organize in response to domestic and sexual violence, harassment, et cetera. And we got three small grants. I think they were like $60,000, and we were going to open a shelter, and we set up counseling programs, and we had interventions for kids, and we started to go to the schools, and we realized like that the $60,000 you really can't do very much. We were all volunteers at the time. And that's what sort of led me to think that this is not just a problem that I could solve by raising a little bit of money and providing a little bit of service, that there really had to be more structural, fundamental changes in order for the women that I was most worried about, you know, to get the assistance that they needed.
And so from what I remember you saying, the solution was to first start helping these women out of these abusive places. You were also on a personal mission to bridge the gap between yeah. the white communities and the experiences of the African-American communities, and how that these were underprivileged. People are having a very different experience. But then the solution was to do what? Was to take these women, help them, but then what do you do with the guys who are...
Yeah, so then there's this third part of the story. The third part of the story is, here I am trying to get black men and white women on board with a more integrated analysis, trying to respond to really life and death situations, because we're running like a little program now,
yeah.
people are calling us. And I ended up in, now I know it's not a coincidence, but I thought it was coincidentally, I was in a jail delivering information around HIV prevention, whole nother story about what we've learned about HIV and AIDS.
Oh, yeah, 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 for sure.
Delivering HIV information. Remember, I had a paid day job as a social worker in a neighborhood health center. So I was at the jail and I turn around and there's one of the women who had been part of our original group in the jail. And I said, what are you doing here? And she looked at me and she said, well, what are you doing here? So we have this conversation and I realized through her telling me her story, she's telling me, and then more and more women are kind of gathering around, agreeing with this story, testifying that it was true, that what we had set up in the anti-violence movement work was, if you're in trouble, call the police. Mm-hmm. Turn to the criminal legal system. That will help you. Now, remember, that was a vision articulated by white, primarily middle-class women who, when you call the police, they come.
Yeah.
Who, you know, actually could get a lawyer. So the legal system works for some people, or at least we thought it worked for some people. But for these women, they were like, we don't call the police. If we call the police, my brother-in-law might be arrested, or there might be drugs in my house, or the police don't come anyway. They don't respect us. They don't believe that we have really been hurt. And so
it's amazing, just to interject, that the Black Lives Matter movement, yeah. I mean, that this is still the like topic.
Still.
I mean, it's still that there is this huge disparity of experience between what protection and safety looks like if you're from one neighborhood yeah. to another.
Absolutely. It really is almost amazing that it hasn't changed.
It's, yeah.
That's amazing. It's profoundly unchanged, right?
I mean, sort of, I don't know if, I mean, it's a negative. It's also clearly you were onto a real problem here.
And it so came alive in the stories of these women in this jail, because they said very clearly, I mean, they had a very sophisticated analysis. We are in jail because we were hurt by our boyfriend or our partner or our landlord. And because we couldn't call the police and we couldn't go to shelter or services. And we didn't know, I mean, those services were not in our neighborhoods. And we didn't really even know that that movement was alive and beginning to provide some kind of remedies, that we ended up being forced into illegal activities sometimes, including that we were criminalized for not reaching out for help. So one woman, for example, was there because she was arrested for failing to protect her children, who were witnesses to the abuse that she experienced, and she didn't protect them by calling the police. Okay, so now I just have to sit for a moment with that story.
Right. Right? It's giving me goosebumps because it's like, it's a talking about chicken and the egg, right? Like you're just literally
talking about chicken and the egg.
Yeah.
Another woman was there because she was pregnant. She was being battered by her boyfriend at the time. She went to the emergency room, evidence of the abuse. She ended up miscarrying and was facing charges for failing to protect, or even at that point, because we've made some progress, but we hadn't at that point. At that point, she was being potentially charged with her harming the child by not protecting him from the man who was abusing her, right? So the irony of this, Laura, is that on the one hand, there were great strides being made, shelters, laws passed, police trained, hospital workers on the lookout, for women who had privilege, and those women who didn't have privilege but were having the same experiences ended up being not just not helped or ignored, but actually criminalized because they weren't reaching out for those services that weren't going to work for them anyway.
Right. And so then, and then you added on top of that, if I remember correctly, that the men who also have come from abusive backgrounds, difficulties, are being locked up
right
in a system that's basically failing them, because this, you know, we all know it's not rehabilitating.
Right. Right. It's failing them because it doesn't rehabilitate, but it also teaches them how to use arbitrary control and authority over people's lives to make them miserable. So if you went to prison today as a man, or as a woman, but if you, let's say as a man, and you weren't a person who used abuse, you're in a setting that actually mimics or mirrors an abusive relationship. You're told when to get up, when to turn the lights on, who you can talk to, and it's arbitrary. And that's exactly the experience that women in abusive relationships face. So you can learn, you're learning maybe how to be an abuser because you're in a system that is so abusive to you anyway.
Right. And even if you had a minimal amount of abuse, whatever it was, it's just enhancing that.
Exactly.
Interesting.
Exactly.
So you go to school, you've done all this work in the actual field, you go back for a PhD.
Yeah. Interesting.
Why? What do you mean?
Well, you know, I went back to get a PhD after I had already started teaching. I was teaching for 2 years as a visiting instructor. And I felt like, you know, the people who had taught me what I needed to know to do my work were the women in the prison, the women in the groups. And so here I was in the academy, and, you know, the assumption is that my professors, you know, were going to teach me things. And I really did learn a lot in graduate school, but I didn't learn this subject area in graduate school. I learned other important things, right?
Right, right. It's like the Ivy Tower, right?
Exactly.
Yeah. So you've had the real hands-on experience in the street.
Right.
But a lot of academics don't necessarily they never touch the actual environment, which, you know, the business school, they force you to go work before you go. And I think there's something to that.
I think there's something to that. I really do.
And so this is the part that kills me. You've created the system to help these women. And in a lot of places, it's not necessarily helping the underprivileged as much as you'd like. Clearly today we're still struggling with it, but you find yourself in a place where the prison system has kicked you out of your own.
Yeah.
Can you tell that story?
Yeah. So when I say a prison nation, I'm referring to the ways that our government and, you know, social service systems have chosen to think about criminalizing problems rather than solving them. So drug use is a crime, not a health issue. Increasingly, poverty puts you kind of under surveillance instead of trying to help people get jobs, right? So that the prison nation is all of those systems that keep people kind of on the margins of society and close to being criminal as opposed to helping them.
Right. I mean, you just said that, and it's like, of course I know drugs and the solution is that these people need help. But it's just sort of hearing you say it so succinctly, like we put them in jail instead of help them. I mean, right. Exactly what is that achieving? And right. I know there's all this stuff around legalization now and there's controversy, yeah. but it is sort of just fundamentally profound that if we just, it's like the permanent timeout for your child.
That's right.
That somehow is going to work.
That's right. Yeah. I mean, we do it with mental health. I mean, many people, especially in jails at the Cook County Jail or any major jail in an urban area, many people there have untreated mental health problems.
Yeah.
And it would be so much more expensive to, so much less expensive, sorry, so much less expensive to open or reopen mental health clinics and get people on a treatment regime rather than locking them up, releasing them, locking them up, releasing them, where they don't get treatment, they don't get medication, and they're surrounded, and they're in this incredibly an environment that where there's so much deprivation and mm-hmm. they don't sleep and they don't eat well, you know, all the things, they don't exercise, they're not out in the fresh air, all the things we know that improve people's well-being, right?
We know that. Right. So we've got a country that's organized around the criminalization of things where people actually, in fact, need help.
Yeah.
And that system is attractive to the Republican
yes.
or certain types of people who right. turn this into a for-profit.
That's right. And it's also attractive, and this is where my work, the most exciting and complicated part of my work, is it's also attractive to people who believe that for violent offenses, the only answer is incarceration. So the anti-violence movement in this country spent years investing in passing legislation that would increase sanctions against primarily men who use violence, in building alternative courts for domestic violence and sexual assault, in doing training on college campuses against domestic violence and sexual assault in young people, mm-hmm. in kind of having a specialized unit in welfare offices where women who are battered and on public assistance can come and maybe have a different pathway to getting public assistance or food stamps or whatever. And some of these are really important good changes. They're important good changes when they work for you, and they work for you if you have more privilege. So on the issue of mandatory arrest, for example, mm-hmm. mandatory arrest means that when police come, they can't just take a guy out and walk him around the block. It means somebody's going to go to jail if there's cause, if there's evidence that there's been some violence. So she calls the police. When they get there, she's got her high heel in her hand.
Oh.
And she says, look what she did to me. Or he's smart enough, because the police have been called 3 or 4 times. He calls the police and say, my wife is battering me. Mm. And she ends up in jail. Right.
Yeah,
so that the use of the law, the use of police, the use of the courts becomes almost an extension of the abuse. And so now we have, especially if you don't have a lot of resources to make it otherwise, up to 25% of all people arrested on these charges and actually serving time are women who are actually victims.
Unbelievable.
Yeah.
It's unbelievable.
The system has completely gone wrong. It's gone completely wrong.
And there was a moment in time when you were uninvited to your own cause.
Yeah. So part of what happens as the work became more legitimate, you know, as more people started talking about it, you know, as the public awareness campaign started to work. I mean, we spent years going around the country saying, any woman can be a battered woman. Rape happens to everyone. And as we said that, because it is true,
yeah.
people who thought they were protected from the problem thought, you mean my sister? That mm-hmm. my niece could be raped?
Mm-hmm.
And so people put in play all kinds of protections for that victim that they thought might be someone connected to them. So that's the good news, that more people took responsibility, but they took responsibility for particular kinds of interventions where it's more, how would I say it? There's more mainstream attention to the issue than grassroots attention to the issue. So the Department of Justice, for example, opened an Office of Violence Against Women and passed the Violence Against Women Act, major legislation, funding programs all around the country.
And that's a great, everybody's probably celebrating,
everybody's
right?
celebrating. Of course, it's being challenged now. They're thinking about defunding the Violence Against Women Act. But everyone is celebrating. But as they celebrate, a few things start to seep into the legislation. One, there could not be services for anyone who had a criminal background. because the office the money comes through the Department of Justice.
Got it.
So all those women at the jail can't get any services. Uh-huh. So programs start to screen. Are you in need of emergency services? Yes. Do you have children? Yes. Do you have a criminal background? Oh, sorry. Okay.
Uh-huh.
The issue in some jurisdictions, you couldn't provide services to people who were in relationships where people weren't married. So lots of people are hurt by people that they're not married to, including women in lesbian relationships.
Mm.
But there could be no funding for any kind of lesbian services.
Mm.
If you were under 18, you couldn't get any services. So all of the things that are kind of in the rubric of what kind of national legislation looks like started to push more and more people outside of the category of people who could get help. And then in one of the celebrations, I think this is the story you're referring to, there was a celebration, one of the reauthorization events for the Violence Against Women Act, where the keynote speaker was John Ashcroft, who was then Attorney General, who was very conservative, for people who don't remember these days, very conservative. We're about to face a similar. And a group of us were invited to come and be part of the commemoration. And then once they realized that we had been part of the group who had said, it's too much criminalization, mandatory arrest doesn't work, the criminal justice system is racist and biased against people of color, we were uninvited to come and speak at the reauthorization of this act that we helped to write and that we were advocating for.
So
it's sort of what happens when our work gets into conservative hands. It gets sort of used against us, if you will.
Yeah, and this idea that you started off, you know, at the beginning with person by person, check by check, raising money, and then the grants come in, but the grants are getting larger and larger and larger, and they're coming from bigger and bigger institutions. And then all of a sudden you find yourself in an institutionalized environment and you lose control of what you actually created. It's almost like the entrepreneur that sold their company and no longer
sees
has.
It sees it growing into somewhat of a monster.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's exactly what happened. I feel almost emotionally about it because I did work hard. And this isn't about Beth Ritchie. This is about the group of us who really worked hard to try to take those stories of degradation and violence and despair and really push it out into the world and say, world, you have got to listen to women's experience.
Yeah.
And you push it out into the world and you expect that the world will somehow like hold it or care for it well. And instead, I feel like in many ways the world has now turned it into kind of a bureaucratic machine where women aren't necessarily getting what they need. Their stories are manipulated in such a way that they fit into categories of services. And the institutionalization means that the conservative nature of institutions have left many people in danger, in harm's way.
And so it leaves you, right, with this, like, what is the answer then, right? Because on the one hand, the grassroots and the great intentions and people coming together in community can get the ball rolling in a way that, mm-hmm. you know, you have control and you can contain mm-hmm. the goals. But then to have a national effect, right? We then play in these bigger spaces. And how do you, I mean, ultimately, right, then it becomes this question of like, what is it that I'm trying to achieve? Yeah. How do I start to break this down? And going sort of full circle with this conversation, there's so many competing components,
right?
Even this question at a fundamental level, which I wanted to ask you about, what does it even mean to have a violent act, right? Where does this originate from? And, you know, we touched on it, but we criminalize different things for different reasons. There's verbal abuse. I love it in the school system. If my son were to punch somebody, he's going to get sent home. But you can verbally abuse children and bully all day long and nothing happens.
Right.
A man cannot walk up to a man and punch them in the face, but you can verbally abuse somebody and not have a police officer come up and do much about it. You can hit your own children.
Right.
So how do you define those lines and think about that?
Well, it's complicated to do that. I think for me, I've started to think about harm rather than violence because the effect is what is important, not only the act.
Mm.
And the way the law works is we criminalize acts. but we don't necessarily look at consequences of harm. And that's a harder thing to do in some ways. The law is a very blunt instrument. It's not nuanced. It can't take into account context. And so that becomes very complicated. But we have to think about the kind of sort of irony of using violence, physical violence, as the matrix for understanding harm. And the contradictions come, for example, we say you can't use violence against people except if they're your children. And then there's a threshold, but it's a pretty long threshold.
Mm-hmm. I had a woman come on the show and 5 siblings, the mother abused endlessly. They were locked in this room. I mean, it was just gruesome. And every week, a few weeks, they would be left for days and then get sent to social services again and then brought right back to the mother, right? So
And the mother may not have broken the law in any of that, locking in a closet or, I mean,
right.
They may have invoked a neglect charge,
yes.
But she may not have broken the law.
That's right. It was just neglect at some point.
And yet, so we have sort of that to contend with, but we also have a government that uses violence in many ways when it feels there's danger, uses it in anticipation. I mean, that's what war is.
Right.
In many places, we see these case after case after case of police using excessive force with impunity. We had the death penalty, still have it, you know, and so that there's a kind of series of, we have football where people are paid money to be, the more brutal you are, the more money that you make, you know, so.
Right. And you're an advisor to the NFL.
Right. So there's a lot of, I think the sort of use of violence, the use of the term violence without looking at how it's got to be more nuanced than just if you hit this hard or if you rape in a certain kind of way. I hate to even talk about it in these ways, but you know what I hope you and listeners know what I mean, that it's completely insufficient to what the consequences are for the law to define what violence is. It's completely insufficient. The context just matters.
Do you feel ultimately that until we define this in our homes as a starting place, that it's hard to then move out to culture? Because I feel there's a bit of a, I don't know, like elephant in the room, in that if we allow our upbringings to be this, the most wishy-washy space of what we mean by violence, right? Like I cannot go hit somebody without going to, that was like a big consequence, but I can hit my own child.
Yeah. I think that it's, I would say the home loosely defined. I mean, I think in the private sphere of our lives. So it's both, it's our home, it's our religious institutions, it's our schools, I think. So I don't want to say it's like we could raise children as if we could do that in isolation from the other influences on their lives. You know what I mean?
Of course, of course. And I don't mean it that way. I just mean if we're trying to define violence and creating a community, but we won't start with the beginning of our own family units and how we define respect and trust and,
definitely.
You know, how do we move out to the broader culture?
I think there's a place there. One of the mistakes that I think we've made in the anti-violence work, and there's been many, is that people haven't linked what happens in the private sphere with what happens in the public sphere. And so, yes, I think we do need to figure out how to raise children in a way where their gender doesn't kind of set them up to have to prove something by how they interact with other people. I mean, that's just so fundamental. Mm-hmm. We have to do that. And we also have to make sure that when they leave our homes and when they go to school or when they encounter the police or when they try to get a job or all those other things, they aren't constrained by, again, those kind of more implicit micro level biases that I think we all operate under, you know? I just think there's a link there that we haven't made. And I think we've done a good job doing some kind of consciousness raising about it's wrong to hit a woman. But I think you're right. Kids may like see that on a billboard or read it on the side of a bus. But when they're actually at home and hear hateful words about women, or if they witness a campaign where women's bodies are objectified and derogatory terms are made about, you know, it mm-hmm. it doesn't make any sense for them. Like, mm-hmm. it's like, what's the truth here?
I mean, the truth is, like, even these small things, like the parent that's screaming at their son
absolutely
for their performance in a soccer game or something, which, you know, you and I both know, witness quite frequently.
That's right.
I mean, you know, what are we teaching them already about their masculinity and tying all of that to, right. you know, this aggression and that
what are you crying about, uh-huh, you know, when a kid uh-huh. is crying?
Or, right.
Right?
Right.
Or what?
I can't raise a weak child.
What are we watching? What video games look like, or, you know, what our kids are watching on TV? I mean, it's so, for all the progress that has been made, we still live in a society that is so defined by kind of racial and gender stereotypes and norms. And until we do that, then I think we're not going to end what some of these problems are.
And is your suggestion ultimately on the back end that prisons, are they of value, or is it really about rehabilitation?
So I don't think prisons help much. And I want to be careful to say to anyone listening that I do think that people need to be removed from a situation when they're about to really harm someone. So we need to figure out how to, like, get him out of there or get her out of there, right?
Yeah.
But I think long prison sentences don't make people safe, and they don't prevent violence. I think instead we need to do something which looks more like what we used to do, which is look out for each other, hold people accountable when they use violence, set up some system to confront people who are either about to or have used violence in the past. I mean, I think there's great promise in what in the field we think of as bystander interventions. You're at a bar. If she looks drunk, don't let her go home alone. Mm-hmm. If you hear your neighbor and you screaming, go over and make sure that she's okay, or check with her some time when she's alone to say, is everything okay there?
Or invest in a culture of social services instead of for mental health, instead right. of
instead of prisons.
Yeah.
Instead of prisons. The amount of money we pour into prisons,
my God,
and what we could do instead uh-huh. is astonishing.
It's yeah.
I do think we also have to do some political re-education, though, around how we respond to things that we think threaten us. And so by that, I mean, and this is like the harder thing, I think, and it's maybe harder for people if you're trying to figure out like what to do right now. You know, when you build borders, when you pass legislation that's about a war on terror, when you dismantle social services and opportunities for justice writ large in general, mm-hmm. then I think you do start to erode some of the progress that we've made that would make it better for victims of domestic violence and sexual assault. And so I think there's some reading and discussion, or I don't know, classes we need to teach, more podcasts about what's the connection between a kind of closing down of access to opportunity and violence against women. And it seems like a big leap, but it's the same ideology that says we're going to take care of our own. There's more important people. There's some people in the world that are more important than others, that we can use power and privilege to protect certain space, and we'll do it by hiring security guards to keep other people out. All of those things are part of the ideology that leads to what violence, the kind of violence that women experience. And again, it's not just a kind of rhetorical or intellectual project. I really think we have to start thinking about that. Mm-hmm. We have to start thinking mm-hmm. about that. And I, you know, I mean, we've got big problems we're facing right now in this country. I don't want violence against women to get lost in it. And so we have, at this point, I know this is more than what you asked, but I have to say.
No, please.
The Violence Against Women Act is, there are threats to defund that program, which would mean many shelters and crisis centers and educational programs would lose their funding. And the reason that that's sort of losing its space as a line item budget is because we're going to build a wall, or because we're hiring more people to monitor immigrants coming in and out of the country. And so it is really a question of what's the
priority
and what's the moral priority.
And people's, you know, memories are just so short. You know, my mother got her MBA in the 60s and couldn't get hired because she was a woman. So I feel like all of us are in such a place of privilege, even That's for right. those who it's not working perfectly for relative to That's where right. things were. And, you know, in great part because of the work you've done. And so I can only imagine how disheartening it is to watch that because you saw firsthand, you know, where
things look like.
Yeah. And we yeah. forget.
It's very easy to forget.
Yeah. So Beth, this is the moment in the podcast I ask everybody, and I'm so curious to ask you this. We ask each guest what an authentic life means to them. So first of all, what does an authentic life mean to you?
Well, you know, having spent this time talking with you about my work, for me, it means doing work that I love, that's deeply integrated into kind of creating the world I want to see. You know, I feel like I, every day, you know, whether I'm parenting Ella or writing a grant or teaching my students or giving a talk, I'm talking about kind of my hope for the future. It may not sound like that all the time, but it really is what
That's
I feel
so
like.
Beautiful.
It feels
I
like
that.
I get to talk about my hope for the future. And so I get to be building something. And it often comes like, you know, from a place of despair. You can see I get, you know, worked up about all these ideas. And, you know, when I teach in a prison and I leave after spending 3 hours there and I just, you know, I have to sit in my car for half an hour to like get myself ready to drive back to Chicago. It's always that I'm going to drive back to Chicago and I'm going to talk about what I learned from my students in prison. And I'm going to convince more people that we've got to stop locking people up and instead look at what the root causes are for them being there in the first place.
Yeah. Yeah.
Or when I leave talking to women in a shelter, I get to go out and talk about what their life is. And to me, the authentic life that I get to live is to build this different world, this world where they would not, where I wouldn't speak for them, but they would be like on this podcast themselves, right?
But I think what you're saying is such a beautiful nuanced detail I don't want to have lost is authenticity doesn't mean, I used to say this a lot, so those of you out there have heard me say it, sorry, but it's not about sitting on a beach and just like being blissfully happy. It's your truth. And so what I hear you saying, it's like truth manifest, right? Yeah. Like this is your vision of the world you'd like to see. This is your truth. And you're trying to bring that out to the rest of us. And that I don't think gets any more authentic.
Yeah.
And so is that something that we've been talking about, privilege and people coming from different backgrounds and the opportunities that people have. Is a life of authenticity something, I haven't asked anybody this, is that something that everyone has the privilege to aspire towards, or is that really a question for a privilege?
No, Laura, I think it's a question that many people ask themselves. And maybe more people who are in very constrained places ask themselves. I mean, I'm sort of reflecting on how you even asked that question. So my students in prison, I think, ask themselves that all the time, even though serving multiple life sentences who might never get out. Because for them, it's how to live an authentic life when you have very few external measures or external pressures, variables that you can change, or there aren't material things that give you authenticity. It's like, how do you get up every day in, you know, a horrific, dangerous, very constrained, hopeless environment and say, how am I going to be like my best self today? Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of people wake up in prisons and ask themselves that. Now, part of it is...
So it's not about the... I love this. It's not about what you attain through authenticity.
No,
it's about how you show up.
How you show up.
And it doesn't really even matter what the outcome is.
Right. And I, you know, I don't want to minimize that people would rather be waking up somewhere else and asking that question.
And if you have...
It sounds nice. But I don't think that it's only privileged people who do or should ask themselves that question.
They just may or have more or less opportunity to execute at the level they'd
exactly.
like.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. And I think, you know, part of what I hope my work does is give dignity to people who are struggling with living authentic lives the same way that other people, you know, who are free, you know, whether free from either violent relationships or free from incarceration, do that. And, you know, from my experience, I see lots of people in unbelievable circumstances striving and actually achieving authenticity. And I'm not glorifying the situations they're in. I'm more glorifying them.
And what do you think is the cost of living a deeply inauthentic life?
I think it's a detachment from this sense of joy that I just described to you. I feel like I get, which is a connection to hope for the future.
I feel like
it's so, you know, if you don't live authentically, you are so moment by moment or so worried about the facade that you're creating falling apart or the imposter getting revealed, you know, and that, you know, because, you know, I'm not saying I live an authentic life every moment of every day. And those times when I'm doing that other thing, it's a lot of work. It's no fun. And I don't find any joy in it.
Yeah.
And I'm not living my best self, my most healthy way when I find myself in those spaces.
Dr. Beth Ritchie, thank you for coming on and sharing your story. I'm so glad I kept after you. This was just amazing.
I really appreciate the chance. This was fun. Thanks.
And if anybody's interested in learning more about you and your work, you are at UIC. I'll have some links to some of her videos, to her book, several books, I should say. And you can find that all at lauraco.com/podcast. Thanks again for coming.
Thank you. Very fun.